It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new report makes the case that NSA phone tapping did little to prevent terrorist attacks.
First, it was 50 years ago Saturday when the Surgeon General issued the first federal report on the health hazards of smoking. That kicked off decades of public health campaigns. While smoking has gone down since then, over 40 million Americans still smoke, according to the Centers for Disease Control.
We've got a Wisconsin expert on smoking and health with us now to look at what worked, what didn't, and the current state of smoking prevention. Dr. Michael Fiore is professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin. He's founder and director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention. Dr. Fiore, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, how big a turning point was that 50 years ago when the Surgeon General came out with that report?
Well, there were a few public health events in modern times that rival it. When that report was released, it was shrouded in secrecy. There was grave concerns that it would impact financial markets and the stock market would drop. It was kept under lock and key in sealed containers. The reporters that were allowed to cover it had to be locked in and could not file their stories. And finally, they chose a Saturday for its release to minimize its impact economically. But the outcomes are just extraordinary. Back in 1964, when this report was released, almost 44% of adults smoked. Smoking was ubiquitous. It was accepted in virtually every corner of our society, and it was a common behavior. In contrast, when we look at smoking rates now, they've been cut more than in half. Only 18% of adults currently smoke. We have higher taxes. We have clean indoor air environments. Smoking is primarily a behavior of individuals with less resources, and we've made enormous progress. With all that said, it still is the leading preventable killer in our society. Almost 500,000 Americans are killed every year, about 7,000 here in Wisconsin. So while we've made enormous progress cutting the rates from about 44% to about 18% today, we still have to finish the job and eliminate the harms from tobacco addiction in our society.
Well, we'll spend most of our conversation picking a lot of what you just said apart. First of all, how did the culture change so much where, as you said, it was such a commonplace thing for people to smoke that bad news about smoking might affect the financial markets? How do we go from this casual acceptance of smoking to where we are today?
Well, there have been a variety of steps that have led to this result. A couple that I just highlighted probably had the biggest impact. When in 1988, the Surgeon General said that tobacco use is an addiction, it's not just a habit, then that really changed the way Americans thought about it. People think of habits as things we pick up or put down. When we start talking about something as a drug as addictive as heroin or cocaine for many people, it really puts it in a different category. Another enormously important event was a report in 1986 that said, when I smoke, I don't only harm myself, but I put those around me at risk. That secondhand smoke is a killer as well. That changed things, I think, as much as anything, because we no longer said it's a rights issue, but it's something that's harming people in their environment. We've done an enormous amount to protect kids from starting to smoke, although still we have adolescents who do so. And finally, there's been a development of a whole variety of counseling and medication treatments. We've recognized it as a addiction, as a chronic disease, and now we have medical treatments to help people who want to quit to do that successfully.
Let's follow the thread of keeping kids from starting smoking in the first place. How important an element has that been over the last 50 years, and how successful has that been?
Well, it's enormously important because if you're losing 500,000 of your smokers every year to diseases directly caused by that addiction, you need to get new recruits to replace them. And much of the tobacco industry's marketing has been directly devoted to enlisting children and getting them addicted to tobacco. Luckily, the public health campaign against that has been somewhat successful. Rates of smoking among high school kids have dropped quite substantially, particularly in the last two decades. So now when we talk to high school kids, about 15 to 17% of them report that they use cigarettes. Back in the 90s, even, only 20 years ago, about 30% said that they occasionally use cigarettes. So we've cut that back. Making the laws that prevent the sale of cigarettes enforced is a big part of it. There's a new movement, including something that in an article that we have written recently, that's considering increasing the rate of the age of smoking from 18 to 21. So that's a new idea. But we can't forget that the tobacco industry is there to fight for their product every step of the way. A big challenge right now for us is that little cigars, which if you look at a package of them, they're essentially identical to cigarettes, are being used to get around many of the regulations we have against cigarettes. Many of these are in bubble gum and cherry and fruit flavored, and many people think that the reason for that is to appeal and make it easy for kids to get addicted to these products. They go down easy, and thus, once they get addicted, the tobacco industry has them for the rest of their lives.
Mentioned earlier that over 40 million people still smoke after this five-decade effort to cut back on smoking. Why so many, do you think? I know the numbers have changed a lot in that direction, but still a lot of people.
Yeah, still a lot of people. And of course, we can't forget the devastating health outcomes. I mentioned earlier 500,000 Americans who die, 7,000 in our state. But you know, for most smokers, getting from life to death is a miserable existence. And for all of us who have loved ones with emphysema or heart disease or cancer caused by smoking, it really is it's a tragedy that virtually every family in Wisconsin has had to experience. So why do people continue to smoke? Pure and simple, they're addicted to a powerful drug. And that's why I think it's so important that those of us who are looking at smokers need to be sensitive to the fact that today 8 out of 10 of them tell us they want to quit, and they've tried at least once and have failed. And it's only because they're addicted to this product that they're unable to break free. New medical treatments are important. Increasing price is important because that discourages use. Ensuring that we enforce laws that protect kids, because if we can protect kids up until the age of 20 from ever starting, it's very low likelihood that they'll ever be a tobacco user. So the reason we have people continuing to smoke is they became addicted as children, they're addicted to a drug, and even though they want to quit, they're unable to break free. I should mention one last point about this. People who smoke today are not the same as those who smoked back in the 60s when almost 50% of people were smokers. Today, smoking is primarily concentrated among some of the least advantaged members of our society, the poor, those with mental illnesses and substance abuse issues, the least educated. And it's individuals who have other challenges in their lives that are often addicted to tobacco and still struggling to break free of that addiction.
We're talking with Dr. Michael Fiore about the 50th anniversary of the first Surgeon General's report on the health hazards of smoking.
And we want to hear from you. Have you quit smoking in the last 50 years? And what inspired you to quit? What challenges did you face? And what ultimately worked for you? What do you think has been the most effective anti-smoking public health effort? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We pick up our conversation now with Dr. Michael Fiore of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, looking at 50 years of anti-smoking efforts since the Surgeon General's report in January of 1964.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think works when it comes to getting people to quit? If you're one of the 40 million plus Americans who still smoke, how did you get started and have you tried to quit? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go to your stories in just a moment. But Dr. Fiore, before we do, you've touched on the point of cessation programs. How important are they and knowing what's out there for people to be able to quit?
Well, they're, I think, enormously important, particularly for individuals who are struggling with other challenges such as substance abuse or mental health diagnoses. Here's the good news. There are an enormous variety of evidence-based treatments that can help you to quit. Are they magic bullets? Will they automatically turn you into a non-smoker? No. But will they give you some science-based support in your efforts to quit? Without a question. I'm going to give just a couple examples. One, anybody in Wisconsin can get free counseling help by calling the free Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line. The number is 1-800-QUIT-NOW. What you'll get is a live counselor who will help you to develop a quit plan and work with you every step of the way. We'll also send you 2 weeks of free over-the-counter nicotine patches, gum, or lozenges. All of that free. 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Over 200,000 Wisconsin residents have called. See your doctor because she can assist you in setting up a quit plan as well as some of the 7 FDA-approved medications. And finally, talk to a loved one or a friend who has already successfully quit because that social support can help. What we know is that if you keep on trying, you can successfully quit. And there are lots of resources now that we just didn't have a few years ago.
We have listeners, and they have stories, and Sam has one of them. Sam from Milwaukee is on the line. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your story, Sam?
So I'm 20 years old now. I've been smoking since I was 11.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you get started at age 11? Sorry, before you finish your story.
I just wanted to be a rebel without a cause.
Hmm. So where are you now?
So now I've quit using e-cigs. They're an excellent product. I have a Halo e-cig, and that cuts out the majority of the extra garbage in cigarettes, and it's just nicotine, glycerin, and water vapor. And a flavoring, and you can buy the flavorings with different levels of nicotine in them. So I'm working on weaning myself off nicotine with that. And that, as soon as I got one, I completely quit smoking.
Sam, congratulations and good luck as you finish up on the e-cigarette program. And Dr. Fiore, those e-cigarettes are a little controversial in the smoking cessation public health community, aren't they?
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd say is to Sam, boy, congratulations. What a success story. And he represents most smokers, and that is more than half of them actually become addicted before the age of 16. Thus, this is a pediatric disease, a pediatric challenge. It's not something that people just pick up and drop on their own. So to the issue of e-cigarettes, I've never been a purist about how people quit. The goal is to get off combustible cigarettes, and he's achieved that, and more power to him. What I do say to patients who come and see us in our smoking cessation clinic here in UW is, we don't know a lot about e-cigarettes. We don't know the long-term effects of them. We don't know how effective they are in general for people who want to quit. we have a lot of other treatments, counseling, and medications that have been tested and have been successful. So we urge people to use the other treatments first, but if they say they want to use e-cigarettes, and what we tell them is use it as a substitute for cigarettes, not at the same time and end up being a dual user of two products, maybe indefinitely. So we've got a lot of evidence-based treatments. We don't know a lot yet about e-cigarettes, but, you know, any way you can quit, more power to you.
Good luck to you, Sam. And we'll go to Judith now in Galena, Illinois. Hi, Judith.
Hi.
What's your story?
I'm now 73. I'm in private practice as a psychotherapist for 10 years. When I was 38, I was in a divorce situation and started smoking. Smoked about 7 years and was desperate to figure it out. I'm a psychiatric nurse at the time and decided to go for, I don't know what it's called officially. I created it. I just got a lot of pictures of dear people in extreme cancer of mouth and throat, and blew them up and put them all over my house, and checked in and stopped to the point where when I picked up a cigarette, I didn't stop immediately. I just watched it and then kept smoking. And then it got to the point where when I picked up a cigarette, I got nauseous. And now I don't believe in this kind of therapy, essentially.
Well, Judith, I want to jump in and get Dr. Fiore in here. It sounds like a kind of aversion therapy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that that's going to work for everyone, but I guess it worked for Judith.
Yeah. There have actually been studies of aversion therapy as a strategy to help people to quit. And there's some evidence that it can be helpful. The problem is that for some individuals, it has a lot of side effects, like nausea and vomiting, and that by itself can be problematic. Again, as I said earlier, I'm not a purist about method. I've been doing this for 30 years now, and I've probably heard 1,000 different ways that people have succeeded. What I always come back to, though, is we have counseling approaches. We have 7 FDA-approved medications. We have physicians across Wisconsin who have been trained to help their patients. I'd go with those tried and true treatments first, but if they're not successful, whatever it takes. There's nothing that puts us at greater risk than smoking. We know that if you don't quit, you're going to rob yourself on average of 14 years of life. We know that you've got about a 50% chance of dying of a disease directly caused by your smoking, usually preceded by a long period of debilitation. So whatever it takes, give it a try. The good news is that most people who try are able to ultimately succeed, and I wish them all luck in doing so.
Thanks, Judith. We'll go now to Tom. He joins us from Viroqua. Hi there, Tom.
Yes, good afternoon. As a recovering nicotine addict, I'm very concerned about moves where people are trying to allow the use of e-cigarettes in public spaces where smoking is not allowed. The reason I say this is that although I have not had a cigarette in 40 years, I realize what an incredibly powerful drug this is. And even at this stage, the last thing that I need is to be in a fog of nicotine, reintroducing me to the powers of that very powerful drug. And I think this is a very, very dangerous social movement at this point.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Is there a concern, maybe the jury's not in, Dr. Fiore, about secondhand nicotine from e-cigarettes or even normal cigarettes, I guess?
Yeah, so I think the point is really well taken from a couple perspectives. One is that we've done a really good job in denormalizing smoking, in essence saying that it's not an acceptable behavior that should be encouraged, and it sure shouldn't be encouraged in indoor environments. I also would say that This issue of secondhand nicotine, there's not any science on it yet, but I think it's a real concern, and the caller's not the first one to mention it as a possibility. That's why most public health experts are saying that the clean indoor air law that we have here in Wisconsin and in 30 states across America should apply to all of these products, including e-cigarettes. That's not to say that e-cigarettes are made illegal, but why not have the same regulations that apply to cigarettes apply to them, particularly in indoor environments? I think that's the prudent approach, given how little we know about them, including the downside of them.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Fiore, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to talk, and to everyone who successfully quit and those who want to, congratulations and good luck.
That was Dr. Michael Fiore. He's professor of medicine at the University of Wisconsin, founder and director of the UW Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention.
Coming up after the news, a new report questions the value of widespread NSA phone surveillance in the effort to stop terrorist attacks. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
A report out today asks the question, is the National Security Agency's bulk surveillance program helping to fight terrorism?
We have one of the co-authors of the new report here to tell us about their findings. David Sturman is research assistant at the New America Foundation and co-author of the report, Do NSA's Bulk Surveillance Program Stop Terrorists? David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The major takeaway from your report is that the NSA's massive surveillance programs apparently don't do much to help prevent terrorism. How did you reach that conclusion?
That is correct. What we did was we took 225 individuals who were charged with a crime related to terrorism, and using court documents, public reporting, and other sources, we tried to determine what method initiated the investigation. And out of that, we found that only one plot was initiated by the Section 215 collection of American telephone metadata, and that it was not a plot to conduct an attack within the United States.
So how were most of those plots stopped? What started the ball rolling on enforcement?
Well, the NSA programs may be the flashiest. We found that the majority of cases were prevented by more traditional methods, including aspects like a community member or family member provided a tip, they talked to an informant, or someone provided a tip regarding their suspicious activity.
Is it possible there have been successes we don't know about because they're classified and as yet unleaked?
There's certainly that possibility. We found that in 62 cases of individuals, we were not able to identify the initiating method. And it's also possible that some of those may have been initiated by the NSA.
And then even if the phone surveillance didn't make the initial connection, make the initial contact, is it possible that that could be used for some kind of ongoing investigation that was started by more traditional means?
Right. Our report found that the government has stated in its testimony that there are 12 cases within the U.S. in which it used the bulk telephone metadata. And it has stated itself that in four of those cases, they did not produce any useful lead from running that information. What the contribution is that they're claiming in the other eight cases, we're not able to determine from our data. However, we know that at least one case, the contribution they're citing was merely the production of an unknown phone number for someone who had already been identified as a suspect.
When the Edward Snowden leaks came out, we had people in the intelligence community defending the surveillance by the NSA, saying this has saved real lives, prevented real attacks. Based on what you've seen in this report, do you think the government has oversold the benefits of those surveillance programs?
Our report certainly calls into question whether the government has made its case sufficiently. Based on our numbers, the initial statements regarding the NSA's efficacy seem overblown.
And later this week, President Obama is expected to speak about surveillance guidelines. Do you think that you'll see any kind of changes there when he speaks? And what are you looking for based on your report?
I'm unfortunately not versed enough in the politics of the current debate to provide any information on what's coming. However, we hope that our production of these numbers will help inform the discussion of how important these programs are for American security.
You dug a little deeper into what the government had pointed to as success stories, some individual cases where they said, yeah, phone surveillance was a big part of detecting a terrorist plot. What did you find when you looked closer at some of those, if you want to throw in a couple of particular examples?
Right. One important example is the sole case the government has publicly relied upon as the telephone metadata initiating a case. The court documents appear to show a two-month delay between the NSA's discovery of the lead and the FBI's acquisition of a search warrant for wiretapping, which calls into question the government's defense that it needs these programs for to look into these cases more quickly than it could with more traditional methods.
So the idea is that maybe this metadata is going to give us some hot tips and connections, but you're saying in this one case that they pointed toward it being used, it was a two-month period before the data was acted on.
Right. In the court decision by Judge Leon on the constitutionality, he stated that he found the government statements to rely on more of a claim of how fast they were preventing it than a claim that the program itself is key to initiating the cases.
Based on what you found in this report, do you think it might be time for the NSA to change their policy and stop collecting bulk metadata?
Well, the report itself does not seek to put out any policy recommendations. Instead, our objective is to provide a public and transparent accounting of the numbers that can inform those decisions. The question of what is sufficient for the programs to be necessary is an important question involving a moral calculus and determinations of civil liberties that our report does not go into.
We'll leave it there. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's David Sturman. He's a research assistant at the New America Foundation, co-author of the group's new report, Do NSA's Bulk Surveillance Programs Stop Terrorists?
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Parents around the state are probably looking for some indoor activities to get kids through cabin fever and days of cold and snow. And students are maybe trying to come up with some science fair concepts. Our next guests have ideas for fun science projects for home and school.
Stephen Vols and Fritz Grobe are the self-described mad scientists at the website EpiBird. Their work went viral with a video of a Coke and Mentos geyser. Their new book is called Build Your Own Hovercraft: Air cannons, magnet motors, and 25 other amazing DIY science projects. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
And David, thanks for joining us too.
Thanks so much.
And Stephen, before we get to the how, why should we do these do-it-yourself science projects?
Oh my gosh, the why is even more important than the how.
Thought you might say that.
Basically because these are the 25 coolest things we could find to do with ordinary objects. And we searched everywhere. And so we wanted to just collect the 25 coolest things, 25 or so, that you could do, and then do them, and then understand the science after that. But first, just do them because they're really fun to do.
And David, how important is that fun factor in inspiring us to learn the science behind the experiment?
This is Fritz, actually. We found that there's nothing like fun to motivate you. I mean, when we first put our Coke and Mentos video online, we had millions of people getting excited about science. And now we find that whether you're building a hovercraft or whether you're turning steel wool into fireworks, you can do something really fun. You can go out there and get your hands dirty. And that really is the incentive to get excited about science.
Now, science is pretty hot right now. But on the other hand, I always feel, you know, as a parent right now, that if I'm going to do something, I kind of need a kit, like that just says add A to B, stir, wait 5 minutes, you'll get a bang. You guys are kind of just doing it yourself from ingredients. Is that a cooler way to go if you can do it?
We think so. This is Stephen. We liked a little bit of sort of a MacGyver twist of the stuff we get to do. So you look around your house, you look around your bedroom, your office, wherever you're sitting, and you go, hey, there's something I could use. And that seems to us to be a lot more fun than getting it all prepackaged. And it kind of helps your creative science brain work as well.
We're curious about what everyday objects can do. So, you know, how to build a hovercraft, that's using a leaf blower and some plywood. Coke and Mentos, you've got those kicking around the house. We're looking at what can you do that you've got in the garage, what can you do that you've got in the kitchen, and maybe you need a trip down to the corner store, but it's the things that are around you in everyday life that can really surprise you.
Well, Fritz, let's run with that hovercraft you just mentioned. It's the title track of your book. Give us a little more detail. How does this hovercraft come together and work?
So we show you in the book three different levels, small, medium, and large. So depending on your ambition, you can bite off what you feel like you can chew. So the simplest hovercraft is just a CD and a balloon, and it'll float on a table. But I don't know about you, but I, as a kid, always wanted to ride on a hovercraft. So with a leaf blower, a half a sheet of plywood, some plastic, you, in about an hour, you can make your very own hovercraft that you can float around the room on.
And it will support a full-grown adult. It will support me, and I'm well over 200 pounds.
How does it work? I don't know. I guess I just understand how a leaf blower contraption can support a grown human being.
Well, a hovercraft is an amazing thing. And the leaf blower pushes the air through a hole in the plywood. You have to cut a hole in the plywood. The air goes down underneath the plywood into a pillow that you make with plastic. It inflates that pillow and pushes the air out through the hole, through holes in the plastic, almost like a reverse air hockey table.
So it sort of distributes the air evenly. Is that the idea? So
exactly.
You get kind of a platform.
You fill the cushion of the plastic pillow below you, and then that cushion also has some more holes in it and pushes the air out further. So there's a cushion of air that's at the very bottom of the whole contraption. That's about, an inch or so tall. And you float on that cushion, and as the air escapes the cushion and goes out the sides of the hovercraft, more air is blown in by the leaf blower. So it continues to be full of air, and you can float on that little buoyant cushion of air.
Stephen, I got to ask, how fast does it go, and how does that baby handle?
Right now, it goes as fast as you can push it. We haven't yet put the instructions online yet or in the book for propelling it with another leaf blower, but there's certainly ways to do that.
Sounds like you're getting close to the Jetsons era kind of thing where you're speeding around. That's always been my dream.
Absolutely.
Well, I want to talk about another experiment you guys talk about. Fritz, how can we stick a needle through a balloon?
Well, we try to give you a range of things in how to build a hovercraft that, you know, some of them are really simple. And one of my favorites is the needle through the balloon, which you think you get a needle anywhere near a balloon, it's going to pop. But it turns out that if you have a kind of like a knitting needle, a big, large needle, you can insert it into the balloon right near the knot where the latex is a little bit thicker. It's not stretched quite as thinly. And if you put some vegetable oil on the needle, you can actually get it to slide in. The latex will stretch around it rather than tearing. And then you can send it out the opposite side right at the end, the tip of the balloon, where, again, it's not stretched quite as thin. It's not inflated quite as tightly right there. And it's quite an amazing magic trick to send a needle all the way through the balloon without popping it.
And what's the principle that we learned from that?
It's all about how latex molecules work. You have these chains of latex molecules, and they're stretched quite thin where the balloon is fully inflated. But in these two key spots, they're not stretched as thinly, and with a nice sharp needle, you can get the molecules to separate without having it pop.
So is that one of those gee whiz ones that you show your kid and they go, wow?
Absolutely. The image of a big red or yellow balloon with a barbecue skewer going right through it is kind of mind-bending.
Oh, Stephen, we mentioned earlier your Coke and Mentos geyser. Can you take another step with that in this book? How did you harness the power in your mini rocket car?
Well, after we first went viral with the Coke and Mentos Bellagio show that we did, it came to us very quickly that we wanted to do some kind of propulsion. And it turned out that was harder than we thought. We first put some geysers on a skateboard and turned them sideways, and that thing went about a foot and a half at about 1 mile per day, really slowly crawled forward, because the weight of the soda is so much compared to how much energy it's got pushing out. And so much of that energy, when it shoots out of the geyser, gets dissipated into the air. And finally we realized that if we put a piston, if we could capture all the energy in a piston, just like in in your car engine, we could focus all the energy that was there and see if that would propel you. So what we've got in the book is, if you take a bottle, basically a Mentos geyser, turn it sideways, and you can, with some PVC and just a regular dowel at the hardware store, make a piston that will shoot that thing maybe 100, 150 feet down the road at a pretty good clip.
Now wait, I'm having a brainstorm here. Strap the Mentos and Coke rocket to your personal hovercraft, and there's your propulsion system.
There we go.
I like the way you think.
All right, I'm going to look for that video in a couple weeks.
Sounds like precision engineering.
Nothing like a good challenge.
Wow, that sounds great.
It's precision and duct tape is sort of the combination we work with.
Now, did I just hear you say the phrase Bellagio show?
Yes,
absolutely.
Really?
Our very first Coke and Mentos video that's now been seen over 100 million times is our little tribute to the Bellagio fountains in Las Vegas, all done with Coke and Mentos. It's over 100 bottles of Coke, over 500 Mentos mint candies,
wow,
all choreographed geysers.
So what is it about the combination? The Mentos, you put it in the Coke. What's happening there that's shooting the geyser out?
It's a phenomenon called nucleation in action. And what's happening is, you've got all of this carbon dioxide, all of this fizz inside the soda, saturated in the liquid, and it's under pressure. It's trying to escape. It will grab onto anything bumpy it can find. So you can see that when you put your finger into a cup of soda pop, you'll see bubbles forming on the ridges of your finger. Well, that's what's happening with Coke and Mentos. It's just on steroids. The reaction is turned up to 11, as we say. So the surface of a Mentos candy is literally covered with hundreds of thousands of microscopic bumps. And each of those bumps is a place for the carbon dioxide to grab onto. So you get, as the Mentos fall into the soda, you get bubbles grabbing onto the surface by the thousands, bubbles grabbing onto other bubbles. All this pressure is released, sends the soda flying 20, 30 feet into the air.
It's really a coincidence of the way they happen to make Mentos candies. We were lucky enough to go to the factory in the Netherlands a few years ago, and we saw that when they make them at the very end, they spray them with this mist of liquid sugar just for coating and flavoring and making them taste good. But it turns out, as that sugar hardens, it makes little tiny droplets harden to make all those bumps. So all those bumps that they create by spraying the liquid sugar on turn out to be the perfect thing for setting your soda off.
Now, you guys are, by all appearances, a couple of grown-ups. But the experiments you are doing sound so cool. It's kind of the things that kids would naturally love. Is it important that both adults and kids remember that science is really
absolutely
cool, and it should
absolutely
still be fun?
I mean, we say you're never too old to be the coolest kid on the block. whether you're in college, whether you're just, whether you're a kid just starting to experiment with what can I do with science, whether you're a parent, whether you're just somebody who's curious about how the world works, get your hands dirty, see what you can make yourself, and get out there and build some of these projects. They're amazing amount of fun.
Well, here's one. We flipped the book open, and Veronica said, I've always wanted to do this, the yanking the tablecloth out from all the stuff without scattering it on the floor. How can we make that work without disaster, Stephen?
There's three things you need to remember. The first is you want to use heavier plates and china. So like a vase with a nice wide bottom, actually it doesn't need to be wide bottom, but a heavy vase filled with water and some flowers and some heavier plates will work a lot better than light plastic ones because they've got more mass pulling down towards the earth than a light paper plate or something would do. The second is use a tablecloth or a piece of cloth, probably just a piece of cloth like a handkerchief, from which you've pulled out the hem on one side. So you want that hem at the very back of the tablecloth, so when you yank it, that you won't get that little bump of the tablecloth that's at the hem, so because that'll knock everything over if you don't know to take that hem out. And then the third is you want to pull slightly downward. So pull down and quickly so that the tablecloth runs down over the edge of the table, and that'll give it a really even, straight pull out from under all of your objects, and you'll be doing it in no time.
And your tablecloth should be made of satin.
That's really helpful. Nice and slippery.
All right, we're trying this, Rob.
I want to see the video when you do this at home, Veronica.
No, we're going out for lunch.
Oh, right. It's on the restaurant. Well, Stephen, Fritz, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Stephen Voltz and Fritz Grobe. They are co-authors of the new book, How to Build a Hovercraft. We've got a link to the video of the Mentos and Coke car, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. It really does go far and fast.
And if you decide to try your hand at any of the experiments we've talked about, send us a video. We'd love to see what you're up to.